Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
And we're, you know, normally we always do these annual James Bond episodes, usually in November, but since we recently lost our first Bond to pass on, Sir Roger Moore, we decided to move it up a little bit in the schedule and go ahead and talk about the Bond, the Roger Moore Bond era this week. And kind of a distinction as well is he is like the only Bond that was like a heavy cigar smoker. There's a lot of cigars in his run of Bond. So with that, what are you smoking this week, Brad?
So this week we've got the Punch. This is the Gran Puro Nicaragua.
Yeah, and it's smoking the 7.5 by 54, kind of like the Churchill size, which was what Roger Moore frequently smoked size was.
Yeah, and this is going to sport the Connecticut broadleaf wrapper with a Nicaraguan binder and filler.
Yeah, because normally, the term puro means it's all one type of tobacco. And, with the exception of the Connecticut broadleaf wrapper, it's a Nicaraguan through and through. And you can definitely taste that it's a... Nicaraguan cigars tend to have that, peppery flavor.
It's definitely going to be up there with the full-bodied, where you're, pepper, cedar, leather... I have yet to still go and chew on a piece of leather just to compare, but in my head, like, it kind of tastes like a baseball glove as a kid. So,
I mean, we got leather in the next room. You want to go, take a bite off something off the tools, leather shop.
And before people are like, "What? These guys are into BDSM?" Not so much. It's more so just
bring out the gimp.
Yeah, we were. Looking to experiment in the world of leathercraft, so
yeah, just bite one of the ones that hasn't had the tanning solution in it yet. That might be
a little extra zing.
It's like beef jerky.
There you go.
It's like unseasoned beef jerky. That's what raw leather tastes like. Oh, and speaking of James Bond, when he's going after these uber criminals. Sometimes he has to call in backup, and, nowadays you need to call in the Strike Force, strikeforceenergy.com. Use your promo code CigarNerds for 20% off your order. Yeah, so you get all jacked up on some Strike Force, you too can probably be a Bond villain. Let's get that level of caffeine going.
Screw being the villain. I just need the dude's class and moves to pick up L ladies.
Strike Force Energy, shaken, not stirred. Oh.
Now available in martini.
I keep seeing all these things about different, drink recipes adding Strike Force. We could do a martini with a little Strike Force in it. Yeah, it might turn out pretty good.
And we did get a shipment of the grape in. What were your thoughts on the grape?
Oh, like I said, I'm always a fan of the grape, especially I drink a lot of, the grape Powerade. Freaking dump that in there. Oh, it's good to go. Make America grape again, as they say.
Yes.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned. When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live. If this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry,
Say live and let die.
Welcome back to the podcast. It's time for some more Bond, James Bond.
Yeah, I remember just talking about this. So, I mean, I knew Roger Moore was the, you know, basically longest serving Bond. But basically his Bond career spanned, you know, both of our childhoods. Like,
yeah, I mean, he did start in like, you know, the mid-70s and I wasn't born until 79, but it's still, this was probably, you know, my first Bond. So I think Roger Moore has always kind of had a special part, because when I was a little kid, you know, he was the first, you know, Bond I saw, until I, you know, went back all the way and, you know, got to see, you know, Sean Connery and some of the, you know, 60s Bond era. But, you know, Roger Moore has always been kind of like, you know, my first James Bond.
Yeah, that's how it's been for me too. And you know, it's kind of interesting, cuz you know, like as a kid growing up and stuff, like this is probably the Bond that I got to watch most frequently, just because he was the, you know, classiest and like most polite of all the Bonds.
Oh, yeah, he was definitely the quintessential English I wouldn't call him a gentleman, because he, yeah.
No, I mean, but he had his flair with the ladies. But, yes. I mean, by and large, I mean, he, you know, I don't know. It's kind of funny, because he had a lot of game, but the ladies really did put themselves out there.
I mean, it was the 70s.
Yeah. It was a different time.
I mean, yeah, like, Sean Connery, he was always, like, the more kind of, I don't know, more reserved Bond, I guess. You know, he was more the, you know, action dude, and, you know, he was always, you know, grabbing the ladies. But the kind of, like, you know, the legendary, like, Bond's gonna bang everything and always has, like, a witty one-liner or some kind of flirtatious response, you know, to get him out of trouble or into trouble sometimes. Like, that all kind of began with, you know, Sir Roger Moore here.
Yes.
He's kind of the one who, and also, you know, the 60s era Bond movie, you know, they had some comedic elements, but they weren't exactly as, you know, funny as, you know, the later stereotypical depiction of Bond that, you know, Roger Moore came up with. You know, his moves are definitely, movies were definitely more lighthearted, I guess, didn't take it as seriously.
Moves like Jagger.
Freaking Jagger, wish he was putting up Bond numbers.
Yes. I mean, there's not too many people that's like, oh, I got a girl in bed, but some other random girl shows up, and then, all right, you know what? Most girls would freak out and be like, F you, but it's like, no, this is my one chance. So, yes, I will go hide in the closet.
It's for our country, dear.
Yeah.
And yeah,
patriotism is a weird thing.
Another thing, you know, Roger Moore, we were talking about cigars and whatnot, to kind of differentiate himself from Sean Connery's Bond, rarely ever drinks a martini shake and not stir. You never see him order one, at least.
No, like, sometimes, like, one may get ordered for him, but you don't actually see, like, the consumption. Like, it's not as big of a thing.
And, you know, Sean Connery's Bond always was a cigarette smoker, like, you know, the Bond in the books. But Sir Roger Moore definitely enjoyed his cigars. In fact, it was written into his contract that he would have an unlimited supply of cigars while filming. And supposedly, his cigar budget for his 7 films, like, went into the thousands of dollars. And almost,
we need to negotiate contracts.
Yeah. And, like, you know, watching these movies, too, like, I really didn't remember it, but now that I'm paying attention, like, he's got a cigar in his hand through, like, most of the movies. Yes. So, I mean, there's, like, you know, several scenes. I mean, in fact, you know, as we talk about the first of his Bond movies, 1973's Live and Let Die, a cigar actually saves his life twice.
Yes.
This movie, directed by Guy Hamilton, made for $7 million, made $161 million. You know, that's 70s money. basically, three MI6 agents mysteriously are murdered, like, within, you know, 24 hours of each other. And they suspect that it's this drug kingpin or something to do with a dictator of a Caribbean country, Dr. Kanaga. Because, like I said, there's one of the guys gets killed in the UN, one's killed in Louisiana, and one's killed in this Caribbean country. But at one point when he goes to the Caribbean country, he's chilling in his bungalow and, you know, having a manly shave and smoking his cigar in his bathrobe when the bad guys try to throw a snake in the room. And he happens to see the poisonous snake in the mirror, turns around, uses his, like, freaking aftershave as a blowtorch and lights it with his cigar and roasts the snake. And then someone tries to come in the room and he, like, burns their hand with a cigar and disarms them. I'm like, freaking, the man is so badass he can make a cigar a weapon.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, you got to be able to think on your feet. I guess that's what makes you, you know, the special agent that he is. But, yeah, I don't know. For me, like, this film is always funny. Like, I couldn't get over, like, the whole rubber snake, like, and how bad that looks. Like, I was like, you know, get a python or something, you know, like, you know, and then cut away, like, before it goes to bite. But to, like, run around with this rubber snake that has the gaping mouth open and...
Oh, no, that was in, that was later on. That was in, what was it? Moonraker.
Well, no, I mean, I thought it was in this one as well, where...
Well, no, he first gets attacked by some kind of, like, coral poisonous snake that, you know, climbs down the... whatever water pipe into the bathroom. But you know, later on, and when we get to Moonraker, he gets dumped in a pit with a giant ass python that just looks incredibly fake.
Well, yeah, and you know, well, and I mean, it could be the other one too, where, you know, there's like the voodoo dancer, the tribesmen and everything doing their rituals and everything.
Oh yes. So yeah, there's a lot of like bad snake work later on. And that's another thing about, you know, Sir Roger Moore is his Bond spent a lot of time in America, too, which was kind of, you know, interesting. You know, you're used to seeing him in, you know, he's a British secret agent. You're usually seeing him, you know, in fighting the Russians or, you know, in kind of European stuff. But this Bond spent a lot of time here in the States.
Well, yeah, and I thought it was kind of interesting, too. I mean, just the, you know, how much of an aspect voodoo played in this film and everything else. And, you know, you see that, too, you know, later on throughout the film series where it's always there's a house on a mountain surrounded by gods, like.
Oh, yeah. This one, like I said, the main bad guy plays a... You know, he's basically his whole plot is, and that's the thing about this era of Bond is like it seemed like as the movies went on, the villain's plot just got more and more like just over the top, yes. Like huge scale. I mean, these guys had to be billionaires to pull off the level of shenanigans that they wanted to pull off. And in this case, he, you know, Dr., you know, Kanaga or whatever, is also
Mr. Big.
Mr. Big. I mean, with the worst makeup effects. Like, when you see him, you're like, is that dude's face, like, burned or something? But no, basically this dictator has come up with a alter ego where he's, like, a American pimp crime lord and just wears, like, you know, special effects makeup to conceal his identity. But, yeah, he has this whole thing with, like, you know, voodoo to scare people away from his heroin crops. So he's like, you know, has everyone on this island country scared of, like, you know, voodoo priest Baron Samedi, when really it's just, like, all an act to conceal his drug trade. Because his big plan is he's going to give away free drugs and get everyone addicted and run all the other drug dealers out of business, because who's going to pay for drugs when you get free drugs? And then once everyone's out of business and he's the only supplier and everyone's addicted, then he starts charging people. Which is one of the most convoluted, like, take over the world. That sounds like a freaking Cobra Commander idea.
Yes. But yeah, I just love those, you know, over the top, you know, kind of elements. And, you know, I mean.
Oh, and this one too, very much like the 70s blaxploitation films. You know, this movie is definitely a sign of its times, where it was trying to kind of capitalize on that 70s freaking, you know, Harlem movies and stuff, that, like, you know, these like Black Belt Jones and all these like weird blaxploitation films. Because it's so funny, because it kind of reminded me of when we talked about Triple X, where it was like the traditional spy could not blend in the heavy metal world. And in this one too, Bond like stands out like a sore thumb.
Oh yeah, like, you know, when he's tracking like in his cab and he's going through Harlem and it's like, they just made a left here.
It's like, and everyone it's knows, like, they're like, one guy's even like, it's like trying to follow a cue ball. I mean, this. Oh. And what was in the, yeah. Oh, and they also, the bad guy owns like a series of soul food restaurants throughout the country, that is his really his, you know, place where he smuggles his drugs.
Well, I kind of like the, you know, one aspect that I thought was interesting was, like, you know, when you got the, you know, funeral procession marching through town and they're carrying the casket, and, you know, that one dude always, you know, approaches and is like, oh, well, whose funeral is it? Yours. And yeah, then, you know, the casket drops over the body and, you know, then it turns into a celebration and we continue on down the street.
Yeah, if anyone's ever seen, like, the, you know, famous funeral processions in New Orleans, it was cool because, like I said, the you know, coffin had a trapdoor in the bottom, so they just kill the guy, go over there, like, freaking drop the coffin on him, like, the body's gone, and they're just on the way. You know, just the level of community cooperation that this, yes, Bond villain had was, like, just astounding. I mean, just the way he could, you know, pretty much everyone in the entire city worked for him. Not only does he rule countries, he rules, like, freaking New York and Louisiana. And then every time Bond would go into one of his nightclubs, he'd end up falling through a trap door. Yes. He's like, the, you know, first time he sits, you know, against the wall, and then the wall spins on. So the next time him and Felix go into a different one, and he's like, no, we're not sitting near the wall. So they sit in a regular booth, and then the booth drops in the floor.
It's like, I had a bad experience with a booth one time. Or I think it was something like, nah, the booth spun me around or something, like, it just.
And then also you get the whole bayou boat chase with the very stereotypical Southern sheriff, a very almost.
I would almost say, you know, Buford T. Justice.
Yeah. G.W. Pepper. Yeah. Friggin' and God damn, boy. Oh, the whole, like, the giant wad of chew in his mouth the whole time. If this movie hadn't come out first, I would, like, almost, like, assume that they had ripped off Buford Justice.
Well, I mean, and it's hilarious, too, where it's like, ah, oh, now you done messed up, boy. The next bridge is, you know, 2 miles away, and, you know, they straight up pull a Smokey and the Bandit, like, you know, bridge jump, so. But no, they had to, you know, one up it. So, you know, they had to do the barrel roll jump.
Oh yeah, that's like, in the next one. Yeah. 1974's The Man with the Golden Gun, also directed by Guy Hamilton. This one also made for $7 million, made $97.6 million. And speaking of that barrel roll jump, because, you know, in this one we have a three nippled assassin. By the name of Scaramanga, played by Sir Christopher Lee. And if, like, and I think we talked about it when he passed, if you go back and look at his military career, he was actually the real James Bond before he,
yeah.
Before he got into acting. I mean, the dude was, like, attached to the Gurkhas, the SAS, and he's, like, basically like, I could tell you what we did in the war, but I'm not allowed. And even, like, after the war was over, he was, like, part of a team that hunted down Nazi war criminals and stuff. I mean, dude was like legitimate badass. And like I said, he plays the aforementioned man with the golden gun, like the best hitman in the world who only needs one bullet. So he's got a fancy gun made of gold and shoots gold bullets and sends people.
And a 4.42 of all things.
Yeah, some like weird ass caliber. But, you know, he'll send someone who's on his list a golden bullet with their name engraved on it. So literally, he has a bullet with your name on it.
I hear Nonpoint in the background. I wonder if that was the inspiration for their song.
Oh, but yeah, this is probably one of the most famous Bond. Like, when you talk Bond, the man with the golden gun is probably like one of the ones that pops up most immediately in your
vocabulary. Can remember, you know, playing, you know, 007 and stuff on, you know, the Nintendo 64. And I mean, the golden gun was like the most coveted thing that you could get on the game.
And also, like I said, the kind of a Elon Musk type scenario issue, because this one's all about
energy consumption.
Yeah,
right?
Them trying to come up with someone had invented some kind of solar power thing that could pretty much put, you know, the world's energy needs, and whoever controls that is going to basically control the world. And it goes missing, and it's been acquired by, you know, the man with the golden gun, Scaramanga, who is, you know, basically he's made his millions being a hitman, and he's got to the top of his game, and this is, I guess, maybe his retirement plan. He's like, if he's rules the world controlling free energy, he doesn't have to kill anybody anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. This film, to me, I think, was probably the most comedic, I think, like, and as far as a lot of the antics and tactics, I mean, one, you've got, you know, kind of that whole, oh crap, what were they called? Like, like a house of maze or something, you know, with all the mirrors and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's where, you know, to me, I think it's plenty of shit with Knick Knack running around, you know, the little dwarf and
who is, freaking tattoo from Fantasy Island.
Yes.
It's one of the only other things I've ever seen him in. But yeah, he, the plot of it's a little convoluted. Yeah, Hervé Villechaize is a Knick Knack. But, you know, I can understand the whole thing where, because he got his shooting skills for, he grew up in a kind of a circus trick shot guy who eventually became a hitman for the Russians and Chinese or whatever, and then kind of went into the private sector where he's making $1 million a hit. But he's gotten to the point where he's like, I just want to find someone. It's all about testing his skill, which if that had been the whole plot of the movie, him like, I want to face the person I consider the best, which to him was James Bond. But then there's this whole, like, the weird energy crisis.
Well, I mean, I think that was, you know, once again, kind of a tell of the times, right?
Yeah. Like,
I mean, how many films do we see now where, you know, it may not necessarily be the main theme, but, you know, whatever the political spectrum or message is kind of, you know, thrown out there. And I think that's kind of what they tried to do with this, in a sense, is, you know, just to kind of stir that political plot just a little bit.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, what does a super rich assassin need with, you know, a clean energy factory? It was kind of a weird plot point. Because even he admits, like, I don't know how this stuff works. I just pay for it. You know? But, I have other people that come build it. I'm here to shoot stuff.
But if you know that people need this out of necessity, and it's something that people are always going to need, I mean, that pretty well puts you at the, you know, top of the top, you know? So, I mean, I guess I can kind of see it, you know, from that kingpin, you know?
Yeah, I can understand the financial gain of it all, but just, you know, his motivation as, like, you know, the world's greatest hitman just seems an odd connection. But then again, you know, he's a guy who's gotten to the point where he's so good at what he does that he finds little challenge anymore. So he has to concoct these ridiculous scenarios where he's built like a full freaking funhouse on his private island.
That's
to
funhouse. I couldn't remember that term. Like
hire hitmen and stuff to come and try to kill him, so he can, you know, practice. You know, and then he's probably has that aspect in, like, you know, the rest of his life too. He's like, all right, well, you know, I've conquered the martial, you know, art. I need to conquer the business world, and, you know, he's a guy who's not happy unless he's on top. He has to continuously challenge himself and continually prove he is the best. He's definitely not a guy that's going to retire. He's got to have something, some kind of challenge, some kind of risk to, you know, make life worth living.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, this film, you know, the other lighthearted thing was the whole car chase with, what's her name in the trunk?
Miss Goodnight.
Yeah, Miss Goodnight. That's
one
it,
of these, you know, stereotypical Bond named Bond girls, who is a very clumsy, you know, one of the worst MI6 agents, because she is constantly, like, screwing stuff up. They're trying to place a trick, because no one really knows where Scaramanga lives or anything. He's like, you know, no one has really even seen him. And they're like, they try to take Bond, like, off the case, because they're like, well, we can't have you getting popped on a mission and disrupting something at an important time. He's like, well, what if I find out who this guy is? They're like, all right, that's the only mission we're going to let you go on, is you're going to have to hunt this dude down, because we can't let you on any missions while this guy is out there trying to kill you. But yeah, she, while they're trying to place a tracker on him, she ends up getting locked in the trunk of his car, and a car chase ensues where Bond runs into his old buddy from Louisiana, J.W. Pepper.
Yes.
Who happens to be on holiday in Malaysia or wherever they're in, Thailand or wherever they're at. So, freaking calling everybody pointy heads and, like, I don't know, old racist terms that no one uses anymore. never... If y'all's get out of your pajamas, y'all might get to work on time. Just, but yeah, the aforementioned corkscrew jump, because as Bond's chasing the guys, they run into some kind of bridge that is, like, not only broken, but it's twisted, and he manages to, like, barrel roll this car, and it's actually the first stunt that was computer modeled. I mean, it's like, that's not, you know, it's way before CGI and thing. They literally ran, like, computer scenarios to figure out if this was possible, the speed, how the ramp would need, like I said, a lot of science went into designing that stunt.
Well, I mean, that's the thing a lot of people don't, you know, take into account, you know. I mean, like in the world of freestyle motocross and everything else, I mean, there's a lot of engineering and stuff that happens at, all right, the speed, the angles, and everything else. I mean, you know, Evel Knievel, you know, as badass as he was, didn't just get up there and be like, all right, I'm going to go really fast and make this jump. Like, there was some planning and, you know, some science behind it to be like, we have to know if this is possible first.
Oh, and then we also had the, you know, freaking Scaramanga's flying car, which was, like I said,
that was, you know,
that was interesting. It was like a bolt-on engine and wings to turn this this car into a plane. I mean, we're all talking about, we always want the flying car. They were doing that shit back in the 70s,
yeah,
man. It was.
Oh, let me just pull up to the hangar and, you know, my mechanical wings will strap themselves and away we go.
Yeah, I mean, you could do that. Just like, you know, you have like a kind of a wing storage lot at the airport. You pull in, you attach your wings, you fly where you need to go. When you get to your destination, you just drop off your wings and kind of continue on. Kind of reminds me of in the prequels, the like freaking spaceships that didn't have like hyperdrive and just had that ring floating in space that they would attach to, and then it would snap off when they got to wherever they were going. Yeah, and then that led to the next installment, 1977's The Spy Who Loved Me, which the whatever Bond or Bond girl naming gets even more ridiculous, because we've got a Russian major in this one by the name of Agent Triple X.
I mean, you always got to have the innuendos. I mean,
yeah.
That's That is the one constant, I think. I mean, the Bonds are all portrayed a little bit differently, but the innuendos are ever prevalent.
Yeah, this one made for $14 million, made $185 million. Friggin', yeah, this, you know, basically two submarines get kidnapped. No one knows what happened.
Yeah, they're basically, you know, I think they're, what, Soviet ballistic missile submarines or something?
Well, there was one Soviet and one British, you know, both nuclear subs, just go randomly disappearing. And this is at a time when, you know, the height of the Cold War, where, you know, Russia and England and the U.S. are, you know, very suspicious of one another. But when both of them's subs go missing, they're like,
wait a second, we now have a common enemy.
Yeah. So Bond is forced to kind of team up with a beautiful Russian agent. Unfortunately, the spy who loved me is a reference to her boyfriend or whatever, fellow agent, who is sent to kill Bond at the start of the movie. And of course, you know, with, you know, in the was Austrian, and one of our, you know, there's always like a skiing action sequence in every couple of Bond movies. I mean, I've seen Connery do it. I've seen, you know, we've talked about, you know, I think Daniel Craig's had one. Like, every Bond has had a skiing action sequence at one point or another, and this one was Roger Moore's with the cool rifle ski poles that he takes out the dude with, and yeah. Eventually that comes to play that, oh, you're the guy who killed my killed my boyfriend.
Which, this film was also iconic for me because this is the film that introduces Jaws. Yes. You know, the man with the metal teeth. And
from the man with the golden gun to the man with the metal teeth. Yeah, he has always been like one of the most iconic Bond villains. Anya Amasova, played by Barbara Bach, was our Agent Triple X in this one. Richard Kale is the guy who plays Jaws, which is a huge
big
dude.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, I didn't realize how big Jaws was until you see him grabbing Bond by the neck, and his hand literally wraps all the way around Roger Moore's head. Oh, it's like, I mean, the dude was a freaking giant.
But yeah, I don't know. For me, that always just stood out. I was like, man, that guy's just gonna take like point a weapon at him or something, just choose through it. Like, all right, well, Plan B, Plan
yeah.
B.
And his like method of killing people is to bite them. When your name is Jaws, yeah, you bite people. That's what you do. But yeah, this.
So if we named a shark Fluffy, it would no longer want to bite. That's where we screwed up. We named the freaking shark Jaws.
Yeah, but the whole thing is, like, not only is this guy capturing subs, he's developed some way of tracking supposedly untrackable subs and also electronically disabling them. And someone is trying to sell the technology because apparently whoever built it for him wanted to make a payday, so he's sent Jaws out to eliminate anyone who's come in contact with it. Again, because, like, a weird Bond villain plot. It's not like, it's not about money. He's wanting to basically start, you know, World War III so he can, like, build an underwater city and, you know, survive it and then take over the world with his underwater.
This is Atlantis.
Yes. With the big spider looking floating city. That kind of reminds me of the Temple of Doom, not Temple of Doom, the Legion of Doom's headquarters in Justice League. And then the huge ass, like, the tanker that is basically, what they do is they end up, like, you know, making these subsurface and kind of disabling them. And then eating them with a giant floating tanker. So it's, you know, disguised as, you know, you don't, can't tell what it, that it's some kind of mobile sub base, because that's his plan. He steals these subs, captures their crews, and then he's planning to launch nuclear missiles from the subs at the U.S., at Moscow and New York, basically kicking off World War III. So he can then become, I don't know, president of the oceans.
But, I mean, this also fit the, you know, we always talk about it. So there was the epic skiing, but then you also have to have the epic, like, I gotta battle a helicopter.
Oh, yes. They, I mean, one of the best Bond cars with the little,
the
freaking Lotus Spirit that turns into a sub. It's like the most ridiculous Bond chase because, like, first it's a motorcycle. He takes out the motorcycle. Oh, now there's cars chasing us. Oh, now there's a helicopter chasing us. It's like, freak. It's like, you know, boss battle. It's like it keeps ramping up and ramping up.
As you defeat each wave, yes.
And then, like, so the underwater, like you said, the underwater missile take out the helicopter overhead.
But I don't know. Like, yeah, I think it's always funny too. It's like, all right, well, you know, you killed my, who was it? You know, I must have. It's like, oh, you killed my lover, but now I've forgiven you. So
now we get Bond.
Yeah, like that whole antic. I'm like, this is not real life.
Yeah, because she's like, I've never failed a mission, so I won't kill you until the mission is over. But once the mission's over, I'm going to kill you. And he's like, eh.
I'll take my chances.
So, yeah, when they, you know, again, Bond has to, like I said, always hanging out with the Americans. So, you know, gets American sub to go check out this suspicious boat. And then they get captured like all the other ships. And Agent Triple X gets captured by friggin' Stromberg, our Bond villain this time, and taken back to his Atlantis base. And, you know, once, of course, Bond is able to hack the subs and have them shoot each other and them escape, and he has to go rescue her. So they end up in this little escape pod, and she's like, well, the mission's over now. I can kill you. He's like, well, doesn't the condemned man get a last request? She's like, yeah. I was like, let's get all these wet clothes. You know, Bond can always, like, you know, screw his way out of a dilemma. That's another thing, too, with Roger Moore's Bonds. He was always getting caught having sex by his superiors.
Yes.
It's like every movie will end with him, you know, seducing the girl one final time and his boss calling. I mean, I'm
pretty sure, like, that's in, like, every, like, all right, so you're going to be working with Bond. So you're a female. This is what's expected. Are you okay with this? Like, I'm pretty sure it's in, like, all the agreements that...
I can't remember how it ended at Live and Let Die, but I know in The Man with the Golden Gun, he's on, like, the boat getting it on. Oh, no, they were on in a train or something and got attacked in the train in that one. But, yeah, in this one, they're on a boat. You know, freaking M calls to talk to Goodnight, and he's like, yeah, hold on a second. And he's like, Goodnight, Goodnight. He's like, yeah, Goodnight, sir. But then this one.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, they're about to board Live and Let Die. They're about to board the train, and it's like, why would you take a train? What could you possibly be doing for the next 16 hours?
Oh, we'll think of something.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the other thing from all of his movies. Is like, there's always the, we think we're done, and then there's one last henchman hiding somewhere that I have to fight. And then this one, like, you know, since it's a kind of a joint task force between the Russians and the Americans, they recover the little escape pod. And not only is his boss there, her boss is there. And he's like, Bond, what are you doing? I'm keeping the British end up, sir. Yes. Oh. Which leads me, probably one of my favorite jokes about that is the getting caught scene from the next film, Moonraker, where he's having sex with Dr. Goodhead. Yes. In a spaceship. And NASA ends up, like, you know, oh, I'm going to send this to the, we're able to get video, and, you know, and it's broadcasting to the White House and to the Queen and whatnot. And then it comes up, and Bond's like, you know, getting it on. And he's like, what the hell are you doing, Bond? And Q's like, I believe he's attempting reentry. It's one of my favorite jokes.
Yeah, Q really doesn't have all that many lines, but that is probably the one that really stands out. Like,
because the Q sequence in all of these James Bond movies are probably like my favorite part of the films. It's like when they goes to, we're going to have to get Q to explain some kind of technology or issue us something for our upcoming mission. And then you always get those weird sequence of him like testing things in the lab.
Yes.
that are always like just the most awesome thing. Like, I want all of these things.
Can I have all the things, please?
And some are just so ridiculous. You're like, how could that ever be useful? But I don't care. I want one.
Just bring the stupid fucking rope.
And that brings us to 1979's Moonraker, directed by Lewis Gilbert. Made $34 million, made $210 million, and also brings back Bond. I'm not Bond. Jaws once again makes an appearance as the hired gun.
Which this one's kind of weird because you have like the manned aircraft shuttle with the rocket ship on the top of it. So when the rocket takes off, like, it just toasts the plane and everybody inside. Like,
yes,
that seemed like poor engineering. I don't know.
Yeah, like, and the space shuttles aren't meant to fly like regular planes. That's why they get carted around on the back of a 747, is because they're kind of like a flying brick. They're designed for space flight. Not like, cross-country travel. And that's pretty much where it starts, because this space shuttle on loan to the... on its way to the British government to use gets stolen and supposedly destroyed. So Bond goes to investigate the creator of the shuttle to see who is, like, another weird Elon Musk-esque super-rich scientist guy. I'm telling you, man, that dude could be a Bond villain. Like, Elon Musk is, like, secretly up to something.
Yeah, this film here, too, was, one of the ones that, got the, it was, like, a production cost of, $34 million?
Yeah.
So.
Made $300. And, like, this was, like, the weird sci-fi James Bond. Oh, because like I said, Dr. Holly Goodhead, who is a NASA scientist working with these people. And it's another one of those, almost like the plot to our last movie, The Spy Who Loved Me. This super rich guy, Drax, he basically is like trying to build a super race. I mean, he's like almost like a space Nazi, because he thinks the world has gone to shit. And he's built this giant space station, and the reason why he stole the shuttle is because one of his shuttles that was under production had, like, an error, and he was short a shuttle for his plan, so he had to steal back the shuttle he had made for the NASA for his plan. Because his plan is to gather up an entire society of who he thinks are the perfect specimens, scientists, all this stuff, and move them up to a space station, and then bomb the Earth with, like, these poisons that'll wipe out only humans. So all the vegetation and animal life and everything else will survive, and he gets to wipe out, like, all of humanity and repopulate the Earth with his space Nazis.
Gotta love some space Nazis. Yeah, this, like you said, this one was just so sci-fi and everything that it was... I don't know. It took on an element of its own that you really didn't see a whole lot with the other franchise. Like, but I enjoyed this one. I think this is probably one of my favorites. And, it's really cool for me, too, going back and watching this, kind of being an IT nerd and geek. And, you want to hack something. Well, there's no longer a network. So secretly, you got to, like, sneak in and cross wires and everything of that nature. So... that whole aspect of everything has been really awesome.
Yeah. Friggin' Louis, or Louis Chiles is Holly Headed. And Michael Lonsdale is Hugo Drax. But yeah, this one, like I said, was so weird to me because I said the... and I like it, like how they brought back Jaws, because you see him at the very start of the movie trying to kill Bond and it not going as planned as always, but then Drax's, you know, right hand man is this guy called Chang, who is like a kendo guy. Like, that's one thing, he attacks Bond with a kendo sword. Why not just use a real sword?
Yes,
you might have been able to kill him if you'd had something sharp.
Nah, we just want to break every bone.
But eventually, you know, Bond is able to kill him, so now he needs a replacement henchman, and he's on the phone talking to one of his guys. He's like, so, well, we need a replacement for Chang. What? He's available? Yes, we should get him. So basically, like, Jaws is this, like, freaking gun for hire, just like, oh, you're between employers? Come on, we'll hire you for our space mission.
I mean, it's all about the colors and the clothing that you wear, so, I mean, at the end of the day, you're still the guy with the metal teeth.
Who actually finds him a girlfriend in this movie, too, which is... in his.
Like, I imagine you kiss very delicately.
Oh, yeah, because Bond is tracking some of the I don't know, the devices or whatever to Rio, and of course Jaws is there to try to kill him and bite through a cable car wire that apparently does nothing because he still has to climb up there and fight Bond on top of a cable car and gets run through a building for like the fifth time. Because like I said, he crashes a plane. No, it was a car, runs off a cliff, and he's constantly like the lone survivor of every like crash.
Yes.
But then some girl like, you know, comes up and helps him once he's like buried and stuff, and a little, you know, freaking Swiss looking girl. He's like, hey, this might get me a girlfriend out of this. Oh. But yeah, and they, all right, and that's the other thing too, because like I said, once Bond ends up following them to the space station, and just basically we get the, of course, the traditional Bond villain explaining the entire plot sequence, and he's like, so, you know, you're going to populate the world with this perfect race, huh? He's like, yes, that's my plan. So anyone who's not perfect, you know, to your physical standards or mental standards, or you're just going to kill them all? And he's like, exactly. And he, like, looks at Jaws, like, see what your homeboy's going to do here? Jaws is like, fuck you, I'm not perfect. I'm going to kick your ass. And, of course, like, you know, not only helps Bond fight the space Nazis with the space Marines that show up, but then, you know, helps Bond save the world and of course, survives another day because, you know, as the space station's breaking up, there's like a piece that's able to, of course, return to Earth somehow and not burn up in atmosphere. But, yeah, it's the 70s, sci-fi. Don't be too logical about it.
We were still trying to understand science at that time.
Like, this movie, I think, was like, because it came out, you know, not long after Star Wars, that there was like, we need to put lasers in movies. That's how we make more money. We put lasers in Bond movies.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, Star Wars put a lot of, you know, technology and stuff out there that, you know, now it's like, oh, we should capitalize on this.
Oh, yeah, the effects are so bad because there's not like, people just get hitting with lasers, and there's no damage. People just, like, fall down dead. There's no bullet holes or anything. It's just like...
Well, I mean, that was
kind of... It's like, tag, you're it.
You know, that was kind of the thing. As many people as got shot and wrecked cars and everything else, like, there wasn't much gore or anything in any of the Bond films. So, you know, like, you'd see somebody get shot, and they would just fall over. It's not like they'd fall over and, you know, there'd be a puddle of fake blood or anything, so...
Oh, and, you know, of course... Probably like the favorite way of killing a Bond villain is, you know, Bond throws him out an airlock. Here, pardon me. You're gonna take this this nice, you know, walk out this.
Yes.
Oh, and some of the Bond gadgets in this one were so cool because we had, you know, the was it this one that had the little wrist gun watch thing that shot darts and whatnot.
Yeah, but I mean, the watch has always been iconic. I mean, what was it? I think the is it the first movie where, like, you know, Q gives him the watch and it's like, oh, it's got super high magnetic power and everything else? Or
yeah, it was like in the first one, he had like the magnetic watch where you could like open doors and unzip bras with it.
It's magnetism.
That's one of the things you can guarantee in a Bond movie. If Q issues him a watch at the start of the movie and shows it has some specific function, there will be an instant comes up where that specific function will save Bond's ass. It's guaranteed. It's like it's kind of like they say when you introduce, like, you know, if you introduce a gun in like the first act, someone's going to get shot in the third act. It's just like, you know, if you introduce something, you have to use it later on in the film, and whatever function of the watch, that's going to be something that's going to pop up. Like in The Spy Who Loved Me, he like had like freaking C4 inside of his watch and was able to blow up and get out of the, or no, it was this one, I think, where he had like the little C4 pack that yes. He blew up the air vent so they could get out of it. And I was thinking too about these Roger Moore Bonds, like the villains' bases got more and more like elaborate. Like this one had this whole like secret, you know, launch facility where they could launch 6 space shuttles and had this whole like society that they had been putting together for this mission. And then the giant Moonraker space station has just like these freaking Bond villains. Like, I don't see why they have to commit crime. They're already like the richest people on the planet.
Nobody's questioning where you're getting your resources or anything else. Just, you know, like today, you wouldn't have a secret, you know, space shuttle. Like, that should be all over social media and everything else.
That is true. All these movies took place before Facebook and Twitter. And
every device had Instagram. A camera and a microphone.
Yeah, there's no way to keep anything, like, super secret anymore.
Two men can keep a secret if one of them are dead.
Oh.
Bond. James Bond.
And then that leads us to our final 3 films, For Your Eyes Only, 1981, which this one I have not watched recently. I mean, made for $28 million, made $195 million, directed by John Glenn.
Yeah, this one here, you know, I saw it, and it wasn't my favorite of the Bond movies, but you know, basically you've got, you know, the British, you know, a vessel gathering British intelligence, which is, you know, has a, like, automatic targeting attack communicating system. And, you know, it's part of the, that, and I think it's, like, coordinated with, like, the Navy and then the Polaris submarines. So, like, this one's kind of all over the place once again.
Yeah, I mean, this movie, like I said, it's one of those ones I barely remember. I'm not saying it. Because, I mean, the plot of it was so, like, weird. Like I said, they're competing over this device that will control the submarines. And then there's the whole revenge subplot. But the Bond villain who is trying to acquire the stuff, some dude obsessed with... His, like, henchman, instead of being someone badass like Jaws, is a biathlete who skis and shoots.
Yes.
his Bond superpower. And the guy has, like, you know, is training a figure skater who, like, you know, is a little too young to be a Bond girl, but she's trying to get old Bond anyway. And Roger Moore's like, come on, I'm a dirtbag, but I'm not that much of a dirtbag. I'm not a child molester. It's
like, how would your uncle feel about this? Like...
And that was the thing, was like, yeah, Roger Moore started getting a little old toward the end of his Bond run. It was like,
I mean, I think this
started to get kind of creepy.
Well, I mean, and I think with this film too, like, this is the first that, like, I watched it and I said, he's aging. Yeah. Like, I mean, it was apparent at this point. Like,
yeah, and of course, as we've spoken about the epic skiing sequences, this Bond villain retreats to a mountaintop, was a former monastery that he's built his base at. And the only way to access it is through a cable car, or if you've got, you know, commandos that climb mountains, you know, Bond and his Italian commando friends, like, have to scale this mountain and fight skiers on on the top of the mountain.
Yeah, which is weird too, because I mean, you've got one, you've got this whole biathlon thing going on, you know, but then two, you get your epic ski scene that you talked about earlier, and now we got to take it a step further. So there's an epic ski scene, but now we're on a bobsled track.
I mean, biathlons are a weird sport anyway. You ski and then you shoot. It's okay. That's just weird. But yeah, then that leads us to probably one of the more famous Bond movies. Or at least the name is one of the more famous Bond movies. Freaking Octopussy from 1983, which was also directed by John Glenn, for $27 million, made $183 million. I mean, in this one, he has, like, the character of Octopussy, kind of not the traditional Bond girl. I mean, she's, like, you know, a leader of a jewel-smuggling kind of, you know, ring.
Yeah, she's got a shady history, like.
Yeah, you know, she's, like, you know, but she's, like, you know, a boss lady. She's not, like, some henchwoman or some young, you know, floozy that Bond has to seduce for information. She's someone who's actually on his level. You know, she's like a, you know, leader in her own right. And that was kind of cool seeing a Bond girl that, you know, was...
not just a damsel in distress.
Yes, was like on his level and, you know, kind of a badass in her own right.
Absolutely. I don't know, man. Like, this film here, I was like... it almost made me want to play backgammon. It's like, there's some money to be made, but... I don't have the money to get into it.
Yeah. Never in any way be betting on backgammon. That's kind of... it's like they've ran out of, like, your casino things for Bond to do. Like, throw backgammon.
Yeah. This sport's suffering. We need to give it more exposure.
Yeah, but the whole plot of this movie is a, you know, British agent is found killed in a circus costume.
009.
With a fake Fabergé egg. And, you know, if anyone knows, like, the really fancy golden Fabergé, you've seen them in several movies. Someone has been hiring, you know, Octopussy's thieves to steal great Russian treasures. And basically they're replacing them with fakes. So no one knows they've been stolen. You know, they're all going to this private collector. But it's also, it turns out it's all a freaking secret Russian plot, as most things are, where they've gotten this guy, like, you know, who's used to buying, oh yeah, you know, I'll take all these Russian treasures you can steal for me. So then they sneak in a nuke in his treasure shipment, being carried by, because they're using this traveling circus kind of as their smuggling ring, and they want to detonate a nuclear missile or nuclear warhead at a U.S. Air Force base, that the, you know, circus is performing at, trying to make it look like a nuclear accident, so, you know, the European powers will vote for, you know, de-arming the nukes, leaving it open for the Russians to invade. Because apparently in the 80s, they thought that was the only thing keeping Russia from, like, taking over the globe was the threat of nuclear war.
Sounds a lot like the year 2017.
True enough. And this is probably one of the, I know when you know, Bond foils the plot and has to disarm the nuke, it's one of the many, many times, like in most action movies, when our hero is trying to disarm a bomb, it always counts down to like 001, that last minute before he cuts it off. But in Bond films, it always stops with 7 seconds to go. It always has to end with that 007 as the final time on the clock before Bond shuts it off.
Call sign. I mean, but that's just appropriate and fitting. I mean, it's great for branding.
Oh, and that leads us to our last Roger Moore Bond film. 1985's A View to a Kill. Which... probably one of the most ridiculous of the, because our Bond villain in this one is freaking, Christopher Walken.
Which, I mean, I think the reason that this one is, you know, as ridiculous as it is, I mean, so many of the other ones are taken directly from, you know, Ian Fleming's. But here, like, this film was sort of an adaptation, but then now we're going to do, like, you know, some original screenplay and everything, and there really wasn't that source material for them to fall back on.
Yeah, because I've read all the Bond books, and yeah, as we get into the later ones, they've kind of run out of novels to turn into movies. So at this point, they're just taking the titles from anything he's written, and it may have nothing to do with the plot of actual the book or the story. It's just like, we need a title that we can slap Ian Fleming's name on and call it a Bond film. Yeah, and this one has our, you know, Bond girl, and this one our bad girl, freaking Mayday, who was a giant of a woman.
Yes,
I said she has been in a lot of movies in the '80s of like, yeah, because like, I mean, that's a girl, she fight the Yucca Man. She was a big girl. Oh, but yeah, his whole plot is, you know, Zorn is basically invented some kind of microchip that can withstand electromagnetic pulses, kind of like, you know, an EMP and whatnot. And, you know, he was kind of, you know, supported by the Russians and whatnot and went rogue. But his whole plan is he's come up with a way to cause an earthquake by detonating a nuke underground and is going to wipe out Silicon Valley. So then he can be the sole supplier of microchips to the world. He wants to be Bill Gates.
All right, this time it would, you know, probably be Steve Jobs or somebody. Like, I remember, you know, the 80s, you know, you were just starting to get, you know, PCs, but everything was Macintosh at that point. Like,
yeah,
Microsoft hadn't quite surfaced yet.
Oh, yeah, and there's this whole subplot about how Zorn is possibly, you know, the product of Nazi medical experiments with steroids, and the way he's making a lot of his money to finance his plot and his microchip thing is by cheating at horse racing, by implanting them with chips that can deliver steroids to horses during races to make them win races.
Always got to have that, you know. What can we gamble on today?
And also, this has one of the, you know, most ridiculous fight scenes on top of a blimp that crashes into the Golden Gate Bridge at one point. This one was, you know, said the last of the Roger Moore films, and he really, you know, starting to get a little too old for the role at this point.
Yeah.
Him hitting on the Bond girls just starts to get a little creepy at this point. In fact, you know, one of the things I read when I was looking up information was like, it's kind of how Roger Moore decided. He was like, when he was talking to the mother of the Bond girl on set and realized he was older than the girl he was trying to seduce mother. He's just like, guys, it's getting a little creepy now. I think I'm gonna have to hang up my my PPK and let somebody else do this.
No half for the
yeah. Oh, but yeah, Roger Moore. Like I said, we talked about him when we talked about Cannonball Run. I mean, he was even in a horrible movie I was forced to watch called Boat Trip. That he was the highlight of the movie. I mean, this guy, for most of us Bond fans, the great debate always comes to Roger Moore or Sean Connery as who is the best Bond. And like I said, for a lot of us child of the 80s, you know, he was our first Bond. And like I said, everything he's done, even, you know, he was on the TV show The Saint. You know, he's a lot of the stereotypical Bond-isms that we all, you know, all remember comes from, you know, Roger Moore. Yeah, the comedic, the wisecracking, the, you know,
I mean, just the flirtatiousness, the wittiness of it. Yes.
Yes. I mean, he was never a guy that was ever, like, stressed out about stuff. Even when he's, like, you know, in the middle of, like, the, you know, fight for his life, there's always time for a bad pun or a quick one-liner.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, it's those, you know, witty remarks that, you know, I felt like, you know, as Bond, as larger than life as he is, you know, the need to procreate always put him on a human level.
And just about every one of these Bond movies, like during his run, the pre-credits or like the opening sequence before we get into the actual story, it's always Bond trying to seduce some girl and it's a trap and people are trying to kill him. It's like every single one, there's like, oh,
it's a trap.
We're here to kill you, Bond. And he has to escape somehow. It's like that whole little pre-opening music video sequence is always Bond, like, you know, almost getting trapped by some chick. But making it out anyway, because he's Bond. And, you know, as we kind of wrap this up, you know, is there a particular villain or Bond girl or, you know, highlight from this run of Bond films?
I mean, I think for me, Q absolutely stands out. You know, the Bond villain for me is going to be Jaws. And then the Bond girl that stands out is, I mean, it's going to sound cliche, but it's got to be Octopussy. I mean, you know, you don't talk about Bond without at least that name surfacing.
True. I mean, since you've already talked about Jaws, I got to give it to Sir Christopher Lee as freaking Saramanga. The man with the golden gun is probably like the only guy who you're like, this dude may kill Bond. Like, you know, all the other guys with their big weird plots and having to explain their whole storyline, you're just like,
but
yeah.
I mean, you know,
that was the one guy that you were like, this guy's might be an actual legitimate threat.
But I mean, I do got to say that, you know,
and he has a midget sidekick.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to, you know, throw out Nick Knack just because, I mean, it's unique, it's funny, and, you know, Nick Knack is kind of devil's advocate. It's like, so what are you going to do, boss? How are you going to get to your gun?
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's like, all right, so does he want the guy to win, or is he, you know,
yeah,
no, he's legit giving a fair challenge. Like,
yeah, because, I mean, like, when he meets Bond, too, and like I said, you couldn't put this line in a movie now because, you know, it would get you in trouble, but, you know, to use the word, you know, midget is no longer an appropriate term, but he's like, Bond's like, I've never killed a midget before. And he's like, hey, I don't care, man. Like, if you kill this dude, I get all this. So go ahead, you know. He went that way. But then, you know, Bond ends up blowing up the whole island. So Nick Knack inherits nothing and is a little pissed off about that. But and also with that movie, the you know, probably I think my favorite Bond girl this run was Miss Goodnight. Because she was so, like, added such a comedic element to that movie because she's such incompetent. Even when she does good and takes out like one of the henchmen, she accidentally blows up the entire island and almost fries Bond with a laser.
Yes.
She was just like the comedic sidekick for those movies. And of course, like I said, freaking Q is always awesome. And final thoughts on this here cigar. This is slowly becoming one of my new go-to sticks. I mean, I like the pepperness of it and like the full bodied, it really, like, you know, lasts throughout the whole cigar.
I mean, it's, you know, I mean, and it's one of those cigars too that, I mean, the punch signature has probably been one of my favorites. You know, but this one, like you said, it's going to be my new, I think one of my new dailies. 'Cause I mean, just the full bodiedness, you're going to get the spicy notes, everything else are there. And, you know, Punch always puts out a consistent product. And, I mean, one of the things, too, that I really like about Punch cigars is the construction.
Yeah.
They always have, you know, just gorgeous appeal when, you know, they're sitting in the box and everything. So,
and this, too, with the Signature Series, you know, that 660 that I always smoke, it's not one where you can do several in a session because it's, like I said, it's almost a little bit the strength of it. I mean, you're one and done with that. But this one in the, you know, traditional Churchill size, you know, it kind of it's still got the strength, but it's not as overpowering as, say, something like the Signature Series. So I could probably do one or two of these in a night. And with the price point, I mean, these are like, you know, around 780, something like that. I mean, you can afford to have a couple in a night and not, you know, break the bank.
Absolutely. And, you know, they're good, too, because, you know, this is a good, what, hour, you know,
yeah,
hour
at least
10, hour 15 minutes smoke, you know, versus, you know, the larger 660 that's, you know, going to be pushing 2+ hours.
Yeah. So I think with that, we'll wrap up and be right back.
Nobody does it better.
Mr. Bond. James Bond.
He feels sad for the 007 license to kill.
Vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.
You're in great danger.
I usually am.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
That's putting it mildly, 007.
I wasn't looking.
You're that secret agent! Found me.
How does that grab you?
Stand back, girls.
What the?
Have I ever let you down?
Frequently.
You have a very good memory for faces.
And figures. Bottoms up. Look after Mr. Bond. See that some harm comes to him.
There never has been.
Oh, James.
There never will be.
Oh, James.
Anybody but you. Nobody
does it. What's Bond doing?
I think he's attempting re-entry, sir.
You're not thinking that.
I sure am, boy.
Tom, what do you think you're doing?
Keeping the British end up, sir.
Hey, man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back. It's Beer 30. So what are we drinking this week, Brad?
This week we are drinking a beer from Rheinheist Group Brewery. This is Panther, and this is a robust porter.
Yeah, apparently Rheingeist translates into Ghost of the Rhine. Whatever that means. But it has a cool little skull on the on their logo.
Yeah, so this is a brewery out of Cincinnati, Ohio. But this is brewed with Morris Otter hops, Morris Otter malts, black malts, crystal malts, and chocolate malts with Magnum and Glacier hops. And traditionally, this is available, you know, this is a seasonal, so usually you'll find this November through the months of February. However, depending on, you know, how much a particular store sells, you can find this, you know, sometimes even into the latter months. So I have personally not had this before, but, you know, this was gifted to me, and it's like, well, what better way to celebrate a gift than to crack it open and have a drink? And this comes in at a 5.8% ABV with 28 IBUs. So, you know, very malty, not bitter.
And chocolatey.
Very chocolatey, which I really like. So we've did a few porters now. And out of those, I think this right here is my favorite.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's very easy drinking, and also in that, you know, lower ABV, you can have a couple of these in a in a run without, you know, falling off your stool.
We have stools?
Sometimes.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, very malty, not bitter at all. Probably the most... I don't know. It's very crisp, and it almost finishes dry. You know, if people drink any wines or anything, you know, kind of feel like the moisture from your tongue is being sucked away, and that's almost how I feel. You know, with the finish here.
Yeah, it does have definitely a crisper taste than most porters we've had, and almost like a dry wine. Interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, the notes here would be milk chocolate, maybe light molasses. So I don't know. I think it's very fitting for, you know, something that would be considered a creature of the night.
Yeah. As they say, Panther is a svelte creature of the night, a midnight malt whisperer. And it's definitely black.
Yeah, so I mean, this is really good. I'm really enjoying it. For me, I think I'm at a solid 4.5 on this one.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. And it's like I said, it's different than more of the heavier porters we've had that kind of tends to be on the more coffee side of the flavor spectrum. You know, this one is definitely more the milk chocolatey side of that spectrum. You know, almost, you know, stoutish.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's really good. I mean, I would almost say something like dry Irish stout. You know, like. But I mean, it's also got a really good fragrance too. It's just all around awesome beer. So
yeah, definitely a good drinking beer.
So we'll get to drinking. You folks keep listening,
and we'll be right back. And welcome back to the podcast. It's time for some science. You ready for some science, Brad?
I'm ready.
Ham horn. Oh. Well, after we get done dropping the mic, normally we talk about our impending robot overlords taking over and killing us all. But while they're doing that, we may have a cool soundtrack to our demise. Because scientists at Georgia Tech have created a robot that can compose its own music.
See, in Georgia, we could create robots that are going to bring bliss to our ears. In Russia, they create robots that are going to shoot us all.
Or the creepy robot dogs in Boston.
Yes.
This robot they're calling the Shinmon, it was originally developed by Gil Weinberg, director of the Center for Musical Tech, which I didn't even know, you know, Georgia Tech, you know, all about technology. I didn't know they had a musical technology division. But yeah, he originally, you know, designed this four-armed bot that plays the marimba, whatever that is. It looks like a kind of a xylophone-type instrument. But it was originally able to kind of improvise music when playing along with human musicians. But a PhD student, Mason, Beaton, basically kind of brought it to the next level using, you know, deep learning algorithms and ran this thing basically through a database of 5,000 songs, everything from Beethoven to Lady Gaga. And it has eventually learned how to compose its own, you know, melodies and structure songs from what it's learned by reading other people's music and how that and coming up with original pieces that, you know, do not sound like dubstep. They actually sound like real music.
Wob, wob, wob. Our air horns.
Da, 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 da. Yeah, because we always assume that, you know, dubstep is the music of robots, but no, that's, you know, done by humans. Where this one is, you know, this deep neural network, and it's kind of interesting that, you know, without, you know, real input of, you know, it just kind of studied musical composition much like a real musician would, and has come up with things that is its own creation, but kind of fits into the mold, I guess, of
pre-established
music.
you know, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, yes, it's notes, it's scales, but there's a theory there. And, you know, using deep learning and everything else, once you understand the theory and, you know, everything, I mean, you know, we've got video games, you know, or, you know, better yet, I mean, you know, Apple for a long time has had GarageBand, which uses, you know, MIDI inputs and stuff. So as you play, the, you know, virtual band in the background adjust to the key, the tempo, and everything else.
And that's kind of how this design started, was that, you know, kind of adjusting its backup music in real time, and has advanced to the point of composing its own music. I mean, right now I think it's like putting out a couple 30-second songs, but, you know, how long before this dude drops a full album?
I mean, that's how most of your rap songs are made. You just, you know, get a 30-second loop and keep going. Start spitting fire.
Oh, speaking of spitting fire, KFC is launching a chicken sandwich into space.
Because aliens need KFC.
Space nuggets, son.
Nah, man, you go to KFC, dude. It's all about the chicken breasts. There ain't no nuggets when you go to KFC.
Basically, June 21st, which is only a couple days from now, KFC is going to launch a Zinger sandwich into space using a high-altitude solar-powered balloon known as the Stratolite from a company called Worldview. And basically, you know, it's... we'll reach a height of 28.5 miles above Earth, not quite, you know, outer space, but it's, this is going, basically they've kind of partnered with this company as a, you know, advertising gimmick, and paying for their newest test flight, which will be the first multi-day mission of this type of a balloon. So, you know, a KFC Zinger sandwich will ride shotgun while this thing spends 4 days up in the stratosphere collecting, you know, data and science technology. And, you know, eventually they say these balloons can be used for stuff like, you know, bringing Wi-Fi to remote regions, or, you know, monitoring weather patterns and stuff like that. And it's a lot cheaper than sending an actual rocket into space.
So how much for the person that eats the sandwich?
That's the thing now. Because it's going to be up there for 4 days. But, you know, hell, I've been drunk occasionally and eaten 4-day-old sandwich. It's, yeah, I don't know how well refrigerated or heated the balloon is going to be, so it might not be the freshest sandwich when it returns to Earth, but, I mean, hell, I'd be willing to take a bite on a bet.
I'm pooping for weeks.
But it's space poop. Oh, yeah, and like I said, it is also going to be streamed at KFCN.space, which is a web address that the first thing you see when you get there, it says, yes, we are actually sending a chicken and sandwich into space.
Why did the chicken cross the road? To get on the space shuttle.
Okay. I mean, hey, this could eventually be like, you know, I was talking the other day about, you know, it's great that you can have people deliver pizza, but we should be able to, you know, order takeout from other types of restaurants. I mean, if they can deliver fried chicken to the space station, you know, I should be able to get, you know, freaking drone dropped off drumsticks at the house. It's the obvious next step in the space delivery evolution.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be something? Yeah, you know what? I'll take a Big Mac and some fries, and all right, well, give us a few days. We'll have that to you.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting collaboration between companies. Oh, and also,
we're delivering food out of this world.
we talked earlier about, like, on another episode, about an experimental translating app for your phone where you would be able to, you know, kind of the first, like, you know, to throw it back to some Star Trek, universal translator type device. Well, a former Australian plumber just invented a earpiece that can translate 8 languages in real time using IBM's Watson neural net and thing. But the big difference in this one versus some of the previous models that we've seen that are dependent on, you know, a Wi-Fi or Bluetooth connectivity to your phone where it can, yeah, basically just run a version of Google Translate, which, if anybody's tried to use that, you know, doesn't always function properly. But this one, built by a company called Lingmo, is the Translate 1-to-1 app, and it's not like, you know, where you enter Google Translate and it gives you, this one is something that can, it is supposed to be able to do this real time. So as someone is speaking, it is automatically translating and broadcasting it to your earpiece, which makes having a conversation with someone of a different, you know, language a lot easier than the whole, you know,
translate and trying to, yeah, you know, hope you spell or pronounce something. Yes.
Yeah. It's almost like a, you know, digital, you know, whatchamacallit, cause yeah, translation is kind of means, you know, like I said, where you kind of decode, like, but, interpreters. Yeah. That's the word I was looking for. So yeah, I mean, it was just released at, like a UN Geneva conference, and especially that when you're in an environment like that where there is multiple countries all trying to have a conversation, if we make that conversation easier and smoother to operate, yeah, a lot more business gets done.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot smoother without errors and everything else. So,
or someone like me who has always kind of wanted to travel to another country, but I don't speak Japanese or whatever, and I'm too lazy to learn it now, that, you know, making an international trip is kind of a little bit intimidating, but with something like this, you know, and it makes, you know, it definitely has business uses, but recreational uses as well is going to help out anyone who wants to travel, but may be too intimidated to be in a non-English speaking environment.
Absolutely. I think that's pretty awesome, though. That's a game changer for it to just do everything right there on the fly directly to your earpiece, and that's pretty sweet.
And back to robots eventually taking over the world. Facebook researchers have taught chatbots how to negotiate. It's bad enough having to deal with a car salesman now. Now you're going to have to deal with a robotic car salesman at some point. They, you know, build, you know, their Facebook Artificial Intelligence Research, or FAIR, has been using machine learning to train basically, like, you know, dialogue chains of, you know, and making these things, you know, whatchamacallit, self,
like self-aware or
not,
like...
Well, it's not self-aware. I hope not, but, looking out for self. They're, you know, trying to find the best outcome to a scenario, and also trying to predict, you know, where a conversation's going and influence how it's going to get there to come out with the best self-interest outcome. And they've done it through two ways. One they call self-play, where they've basically had them kind of negotiating between each other. But after a few rounds of this, you know, the robots or the AI started kind of developing its own language, so that really wouldn't help dealing with humans. And the other one is, like I said, kind of dialogue rollout, where, like I said, where they're trying to, based on conversations, predict where a conversation's going and steer it to the best outcome for them. So yeah, it's kind of interesting that, you know, I'm trying to think of an application of this type of computer. I just think we should get another, you know, another Terminator movie instead of the Terminator. Now the Negotiator.
Yeah, that's probably next.
Come with me if you want the deal on car insurance.
Affleck.
Or it reminds me of, was it Demolition Man, when the computer's telling the officer how to negotiate the situation? We get like robotic police negotiators talking people down. If you would like to give us our list of demands, please press 2.
I mean, that may be, you know, I mean, in an era of, you know, so much political correctness and everything else, I mean, maybe the only way to get an unbiased opinion, it's always going to go toward the robot's favor.
Yeah. Oh, and you're buying stuff online. You got to negotiate your price with a robot.
And the robot's like, did you just assume my binary?
God damn it. Oh, yeah, I think I'm done on that one. With that, we'll be right back.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Check out Rec Level 3.
What's that?
We're a gaming, geek, nerd culture fandom podcast.
Ooh. Wow.
And you can find us every Friday at 11:30 a.m. on RecLevel3.com.
Yay!
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News. Here we got an extensive lineup. We had a little video game conference wrap up called E3. So we'll be going over, quite a bit of what we're looking forward to, what we weren't quite as enthused about, and what we think the future beholds. But before we jump into that, let's go ahead and get some movie news out of the way. So we got our teaser trailer released for the Black Panther.
Speaking of drinking the Panther.
Yes.
Talk about the Black Panther.
I don't know how it really tied into Bond, but at least we made it tie into news, right? I mean.
True that. I'm sure Bond has fought a panther at one time or another. They're always trying to kill him in weird ways.
Yeah. Absolutely. So Black Panther is set to hit theaters February 16th of 2018. This is going to follow the events of Captain America Civil War. With this, I got to say, like, after seeing the trailer and everything else, I'm excited for this. I think that this film is going to be pretty epic. The original teaser was played during Game 4 of the NBA Finals, and, now we've actually got, the standalone trailer. So,
yeah, and it looks interesting. I mean, it definitely looks different than some of the previous, Marvel stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of keeping that gritty trend going, though.
Yeah.
Because, it looks stylish and futuristic as well. So, kind of the whole African folk culture meets, modern technology. And
yeah, it's definitely a kind of a cool, like whatever the opposite of symmetry like is, where it's like super high tech stuff next to guys like, in traditional African garb. It's like a mix of like high tech and, low tech. It's kind of cool seeing like stuff that looks like spaceships and stuff, like in like a traditional village type setting and stuff. It's kind of an odd connection.
Kind of remind me, a little bit like Stargate. Like you would see that a lot, where you had these like very futuristic things occurring in wilderness environments and stuff like that. So I don't know. I'm excited for it.
And like the action sequences we get look pretty badass. More of the hopping from car to car that we got from Captain America Civil War. He's like, kind of Iron Man-esque looking. But one of the things that we didn't see in the trailer is any of the other Avengers. So it's like, is this one going to be cameo-free? We did see, what's his name, the Avengers liaison guy in it. But other than that, you didn't see, Tony or Cap or anything else, and with the end of Captain America Civil War, Steve and Bucky were both in Wakanda, so you would assume they may show up and be part of the plot somehow. But yeah, so far they've not given us any of that.
Well, this is still, very early on. We've got almost a year wait, give or take.
This is so different from the Spider-Man trailer, where they're like, hey, look, Iron Man.
Show everything.
Here's Iron Man. We got Iron Man in this movie, guys. This one's been...
We have guys in, freaking Hulk mask and the other Avenger mask, so...
And I did like some... obviously, with the end of Captain America Civil War, T'Challa is, like, very new at being the leader of his country. And this looks like it's going to be, him trying to find his place as both warrior and king. And there's a great voiceover quote that is like, you are a good man, but it's very hard for a good man to be a good king. Almost like, you have to get a little dirty if you're going to,
Yeah, I mean, there's
play the politics again.
I mean, there's going to be tough decisions to be made and everything else. So,
and of course, we see Andy Serkis in there that we got him, you know, briefly in Age of Ultron, but he was, you know, that character he plays was always a Black Panther villain. So it's going to be cool seeing him go full Dr. Claw. Or
yes.
Because we know he got his arm chopped off, so now he can get the cool, like, robo-laser arm that he always had in the comic books. I'm definitely, you know, like I said, the last couple movies come out have all been just a little bit different from the traditional MCU mold. So I'm looking forward to see what new shenanigans they come up with this round.
Absolutely. You know, just kind of skipping gears a little bit. You know, we talked about Star Trek Discovery. We did finally get a release date. So it looks like Sunday, September, 24th at 8:30 on CBS and online at CBS All Access. So,
yeah, I mean, the trailer for it looks interesting, but the fact that it's not on TV, that it's on that, I'm not paying for another streaming service. So I guess I'll wait till it eventually gets released on video before I catch up with this, because it's just not cool enough for me to pay another $20 a month or whatever.
And it's kind of weird, too, you know. So they're talking about a 15-episode first season, but they're going to split it into two parts. So the final seven episodes won't actually begin airing until January of 2018. So, you know, I don't know. Do you think it's... We'll see how the first half goes, and if it bombs...
One of those,
you know, do we have a contingency plan?
Yeah, because Star Trek can be, especially if you do it on the non-original series type, but they can be expensive.
Yes.
And this looks like, you know, at least from the trailers, that it's, there's some big, epic, almost movie quality sequences. So, yeah, if they, with this out being, without being on regular TV and on a subscription service, they may be hedging their bets with, like, oh, we made no money on this, so we may just go ahead and forget about that second season.
So kind of keeping along with the TV trend, CW has released their fall schedule for its superhero lineup. So, you know, on Mondays you can get Supergirl and Valor, which will be having a season premiere on October 9th at 9 p.m.
Yeah, I've not heard anything about Valor yet.
Tuesdays, you can catch The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow. That's going to be October 10th at 8 and 9 p.m. And then October 11th, we're going to get Riverdale Season 2 premiere and Dynasty season premieres at 8 and 9. And then Thursday, we'll get Supernatural and then Arrow at 8 and 9. And then Fridays, you get Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. That sounds about every weekend, yeah. And
we've not talked about it, but the Supernatural Scooby-Doo crossover, animated crossover that they've talked about. That, like I said, I've kind of went away from Supernatural the last couple seasons. I got a little burned out at it, you know, going on whatever 12 years now. But I may have to tune back in for the Scooby-Doo crossover, because that just sounds freaking awesome.
And who was it? There was somebody. I think it was James Gunn. That, you know, has basically, you know, given us now an R-rated Scooby-Doo.
Oh God!
Yes. So, apparently, I got to do some more research. The headline just, you know, crossed my desktop a little bit ago, so I haven't had a chance to dive into it in too much depth, but you know, if you're interested in what an R-rated Scooby-Doo, just look at James Gunn, R-rated Scooby-Doo, and read all the details.
I mean, Rocket Raccoon's kind of a Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, apparently there's sex and everything else, so I mean...
Oh, that's like, I saw a meme the other day of, Daphne, tied up, and it was like, I blame my Saturday morning cartoons for my obsessions with redheads and bondage.
Sounds about right. So kind of, you know, keeping along, you know, the TV theme, we did get a bit of bad news. So, you know, Adam West, TV's Batman, yeah, he did pass away at age 88.
Pretty much most people's first Batman. Yeah, like I'm not old enough to have watched it, but it was always on like TBS reruns on Saturday mornings when I was a kid. And like I said, yeah, he's just been one of those. And then his portrayal of the mayor on Family Guy. He's just one of those guys who's like always been around in some form or another. And was also like before Roger Moore, to tie it back to the main topic, before Roger Moore was hired as Bond, he was kind of pursued at one point to possibly be the new Bond. So yeah, it's like, you know, it's one of those guys. It's like, you know, king of the nerds, you know, the godfathers of nerddom, that's just been around forever. And the thing that I thought was nice that LA did for him is they dusted off the old bat signal and lit up City Hall with the bat signal.
Yes,
for a
I
night,
thought that was a very fitting tribute
to Adam.
So you know, as we kind of keep going along here, so you know, from here on out, we're going to talk, you know, really video games. And you know, a bit of news that I thought was relatively exciting is Atari is apparently working on a new game console. And they basically released a 20-second, you know, teaser, which shows kind of the wood grain that you would expect from the old Atari age. But then, nice. You know, also, too, has a, you know, LED Atari symbol, you know, glowing. So I'm not quite sure, you know, how they're going to jump into the market. I mean, I don't really see them getting into next gen and trying to compete with the, you know, PC Master Race or, you know, PS4 or Xbox One, but
Atari's never really went away. They've just kind of moved into the coin-op market mainly. So they've still been making stuff, but just like, yeah, it's been a long time since Atari has been in the home,
yeah, I mean,
home system market.
I mean, what we had the Jaguar that was in 93 and discontinued in 96. So they're calling this Atari Box, and I don't know, outside of that it's been years in the making, if they're going to try to go, you know, something that's going to play retro games, or
their stuff is almost too retro, I think, for the retro market. Everyone loved whatever that Nintendo retro thing came out, but you know, freaking your cell phone has more detailed games now than the old 2600 could provide. So it's almost like, what is this weird archaic technology if they go the retro route?
It has been said that the Atari Box is based on PC technology. So it's not going to be, you know, 8-bit retro, I don't think. You know, I'm almost wondering if maybe we get like a NES, you know, classic throwback type thing. I don't know. We'll keep folks surprised as more information is made available, but I mean, I'm definitely curious. Something else that you know, really caught my attention is a PS4 exclusive. This is, you know, basically the 9-minute gameplay video of the new Spider-Man game.
Yes, and this looks amazing. I've not played really any other Spider-Man games except for, I played Spider-Man in the whatever Marvel Ultimate Alliance. But yeah, the Spider-Man specific games, I've not really played any of them. But this one looks to me like the game engine has to be the same, because a lot of the gameplay elements looked a lot like Arkham Knight, especially like the stealth missions that they were demoing. It looked a lot like, you know, instead of whatever Detective Vision, you've got spider senses now and stuff. It's very reminiscent of Arkham Knight, except in the daylight.
This is the first licensed title from Insomniac Games. And they brought us, you know, some exclusives like Resistance, Ratchet & Clank, a game called Sunset Overdrive that was free on Xbox One for a while with Games with Gold. And I found that game to be an absolute blast. So I don't know. I mean, you know, this to me really felt like Spider-Man. I mean, you've got the aerobatics, you've got the, you know, goofy humor and everything else. So I don't know. Like, I'm a little bit hesitant, but I can honestly say it looks awesome, and I'm excited to give this a play. And then up next is basically, you know, just some other stuff that was announced at E3 that I'm excited for. So basically, you know, Nintendo has revealed Metroid Prime 4 is in development for the Nintendo Switch. They've got Metro, a third game that is set, I think, to release on the DS or something, but, you know, I don't think that they're expecting it to really take off, as, you know, since they've mentioned Metro Prime 4 so early in the development phase.
Yeah, and that was the other thing that I saw was the new Mario game coming out looked weird.
Oh, but it looks awesome. I don't know if you've watched the gameplay. So what Joe's talking about is Super Mario Odyssey. And basically, you know, you're going to be able to, you know, use, you know, different mushrooms. So instead of fireballs and, you know, and enlarging yourself and that type of thing, you know, here it looks like you're going to be given, you know, eldritch powers, that, you know, can apparently, you know, be used to, inhabit both living and inanimate objects. I mean, I've seen them turn into taxis, dinosaurs, statues.
And it's set in the real world instead of, like, the Mushroom Kingdom. It's like Mario walking around, like, you know, a digital New York and possessing people.
Yeah. I mean, which... It kind of looks cool. I mean, it almost reminds me, you know, I mean, of the, like, 64, where you're getting the 3D world and everything else. So, from that aspect, like, I'm excited. Like, I mean...
Yeah, visually, it just looks weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely unique.
Traditional Mario next to, like, regular-looking people.
We did get a full reveal for Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus. Always been a big fan of the Wolfenstein franchise, and, you know, with the updated graphics and everything else, you know, it looks like a bloody good time. Then we got, let's see here, it was... Hidden Agenda looked pretty good. Vampire for PS4 looks absolutely
Vampire
amazing.
Vampire the
Masquerade? no, this is more, you know, I mean, it looks like it's going to basically be a single player only, but it's like a vampire RPG where you get a choice.
Like Vampire the Masquerade.
So... I would guess so, you know, but I think it's trying to take the route of, like, your Until Dawn, where every decision will not only affect the immediate objective at hand, but also, you know, you or your kin, you know, those later parts of the game. So, and, you know, we did get a look at Star Wars Battlefront 2.
Yeah.
I gotta say that, you know... I think maybe they've learned from some of the mistakes of, you know, Battlefront, and, you know, are looking to...
I like that this one spans pretty much the entire, like, you know, time frame of the movie, so you can play prequel era, classic era, or, like, the new era, so you get the traditional stormtroopers, and you get the creepy stormtroopers. But then also adding a single player element to it as well, because that was the one thing that, you know, kind of bored me with the last Battlefront. It looked awesome, but there's only so much, you know, online play. I'd like something with some kind of storyline. So I'm interested to see the single player campaign mode that they've added to this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're running out of time here, so quickly some other highlights: Skull and Bones. big fan of pirates and pirate ships and such. Kind of reminds me a little bit of Assassin's Creed Black Flag, but on a little bit more grander scale.
That's the description I've heard. It's like Black Flag without the assassins.
Yeah.
It's just the pirates.
God of War, or Dad of War, as a lot of folks are calling it. You know, always been a big fan of that franchise. Of course, Far Cry 5, and, you know, then Metro Exodus. So, you know, those are the ones that I'm looking forward to. Give us your thoughts, your feedbacks on what you're anticipating.
And if that's it, check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. We're also on the ESO at ESO Podcast Network, or ESOPodcast.com. Check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you find your podcasts. Go leave us a review, a rating, help you know people find the show. Go to StrikeForceEnergy.com for your all your energy needs. Don't forget to use your promo code CigarNerds. Also, check out RealMenSmokeCigars.com for your cool Cigar Nerd smoking shirt. And also, you know, normally we end the show with a movie quote, but, you know, I was reading an article of great quotes from Roger Moore himself, and there was two particularly that I wanted to leave you with tonight. One of them was, "Of course I do my own stunts, and I also do my own lying." And one that's good advice about life: if you don't have humor, then you might as well nail the coffin lid down now. We out! And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.